well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Variant Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with a friend, Mark Walters from Armed American Radio, here in just a second about the big topic on the Sunday Night Monster Cast. No news from the Supreme Court. No new cases granted cert on Monday morning. We do have some legal news, however, though, up at BearingArms.com. Supreme Court asked to consider another case. This one, a challenge to Illinois' ban on lawful concealed carry on public transportation. It's a case called Schoenthal versus Raul. District Court judge actually sided with the plaintiff, said, yeah, this is unconstitutional. Issued an injunction as it applied to the individual plaintiffs, did not strike down the law in its entirety. Seventh Circuit hears a case, says, oh, no. Judge got it all wrong. This is a case of crowded public spaces, and there's a national tradition of banning firearms in crowded spaces. Even though the Supreme Court in Bruin specifically said that New York City could not make Manhattan a gun-free zone because it is a crowded place. Yeah, which, by the way, the plaintiffs raised in their cert petition to the Supreme Court, saying that the court's involvement is necessary now, even though there's, I don't think there's a circuit court split on this issue. But one is not necessarily needed here in order for the court to address the abuses that we've seen from lower courts in their expansive definition of a national tradition of sensitive places that would apply to Times Square, public transportation in New York City, public transportation in Chicago, public transportation in certain areas of California, all of which I think have been subject to various lawsuits. So fingers crossed that the Supreme Court will grant cert to this case. It'll probably be early January before they would have a chance to really consider this in conference. But if they grant it cert quickly, still be here oral arguments in the spring and get a decision later this term. Of course, the Supreme Court has already granted cert to two cases. I think they, you know, the odds of them taking any given case are something like 1 in 10,000. But I still think that there's another issue out there where you've got a circuit court split that I would not be surprised to see the Supreme Court take a third case, maybe even a fourth case this year dealing with our right to keep your arms, but a third case specifically dealing with the issue of adults under the age of 21 and their Second Amendment rights. There is the NRA challenge to Florida's ban on all gun sales to adults under the age of 21. There are two challenges out of the Fourth Circuit, West Virginia Citizens Defense League, and then another case, McCoy versus ATF, dealing with handgun sales to under 21s, the federal prohibition on handgun sales. Fourth Circuit has upheld that law. The Fifth Circuit in Reese versus ATF did not uphold that law, and the DOJ decided not to appeal that case. So there again, there's a circuit court split over the issue here. There's also, Paris versus SAF, which deals with the carry rights of under 21s. That is pending before the Supreme Court as well. So I think given the circuit court split, given the variety of issues that are at hand here as to when exactly our right to keep our arms kicks in, is it when we become an adult at age 18, or do we have to wait until we turn 21? Because in 1791, that was considered the age of majority. I suspect that, I would not be surprised to see the court grant cert to one or more of those cases, because this is a live question that is percolating around the lower courts, and there is disagreement as to what the Constitution says and what is allowed under the Second Amendment. So we're keeping our eyes on those cases. But in our conversation with Mark Walters, we talked a little bit about a case already decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. This was Mexico versus Smith & Wesson, the $10 billion lawsuit the government of Mexico filed against many U.S. gun makers, alleging that they were knowingly contributing to cartel violence by producing guns here in the United States and selling them here in the United States. Supreme Court unanimously rejected that argument and tossed out Mexico's lawsuit. But as Cheryl Atkinson wrote a few days ago in a piece of the Baltimore Sun, while it's true that U.S. manufactured weapons are being seized from cartels south of the border, What Mexico didn't say is that the vast majority of those guns were purchased by the Mexican government or its subsidiaries and then illegally diverted to the cartels. Take a look and a listen. Mark, greetings, sir. Thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Absolutely. I enjoy the Mondays with Mark. It's a nice chance to, I don't always get a chance to catch the Sunday Monster cast. So it is, if nothing else, a nice opportunity for me to ask, what was the big topic of the week on the show? And so let me ask, what was the big topic on the Monster cast last night?
Mexico been feeding our guns that they've been buying from the Mexican government to their cartels and blaming U.S. gun owners and U.S. gun manufacturers for their problems. Obviously, it's been hidden by the Biden administration, Cam, for the last 5 years. They knew it. And the bigger part of this story, I think, is we all knew it. Couldn't really prove it. We knew it. We knew something was amiss, but we couldn't prove it. Well, now that proof is out. Cheryl Atkinson did an amazing report. The Baltimore Sun ran with it, as you're familiar with, in an incredible report, a bombshell report, actually, that blew the lid off of the entire thing over the last few years. But the bigger part of that story is the American gun grabber organizations, the Every Town for Gun Safeties, the Giffords, et cetera, working in conjunction with the Biden administration and the U.S. media to keep that under wraps. And Cheryl Atkinson, God bless her for busting this out. We now know that roughly 80% of the crime guns, to use their words, found at the scenes of murders in Mexico, those guns that have been found, over 80% were purchased by the Mexican government originally for the military and law enforcement, winding up in the hands of the cartels. And they've been blaming us. And what does Mexico do? Comes across our border with help of American gun grabbers and sues our gun manufacturers in our U.S. Supreme Court. Just a remarkable story, a huge, huge, huge story that I like to think since it was the Baltimore Sun that ran with this, I don't know much about the Baltimore Sun other than like most major media newspaper outlets, it tends to lean left. But Cheryl Atkinson did an amazing job on this. And I would hope that some of the other mainstream media, since it did pop up in the Baltimore Sun and is getting a lot of coverage now, maybe we see it on ABC and NBC, and so we can all CBS and CNN, LOL, and MSDNC. I'm not going to hold my breath, but it would be nice if they picked it up because facts are facts.
Absolutely. This is something that Cheryl Atkinson has been talking about for years. Mm-hmm. Going back to Operation Fast and Furious and the death of Brian Terry. I mean, I remember having Cheryl on Cam and Company back when I was still doing the show on NRA. I think it was NRA News. This was even pre-NRA TV. And she did some great work for CBS News at the time where she was working. And she talked about how, a lot of these guns that are lawfully purchased by the Mexican government for military or law enforcement, they lost those guns. They couldn't account for tens of thousands of those firearms, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, we've known this is going on for well over a decade. But as you say, it's hard to get those numbers, right? And so, when you see the headlines about, U.S. sourced guns turning up at crime scenes, well, that's true to a degree, right? These are guns that were manufactured perhaps in the United States, sold by U.S. gun makers, but they were sold to the Mexican government.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And after they legally were imported into Mexico, they were then illegally diverted to the cartels. And this is happening, by the way, not just at the federal level. It's happening at the state level. You'll have corrupt police chiefs who will place their orders for firearms, ostensibly for their police departments. And then lo and behold, those guns go missing. They end up in the hands of the cartels. And as you say, Mexico knows that this is going on, right? But to acknowledge that this is going on is to acknowledge that Mexico is a failed, corrupt narco state. And the AMLO administration did not want to acknowledge that. I don't think the current administration, I'm blanking on who the current president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum.
Sheinbaum, yeah.
I don't think she wants to acknowledge, I don't think she can acknowledge that either, right? I mean, we know, Mark, that AMLO, the former Obrador, the former president of Mexico, he was the subject of two U.S. federal investigations into cartel ties that were dropped I believe the first was dropped under the Obama administration. The second was dropped during the Biden administration. They didn't want to know. They didn't want to know. They didn't want to go there, right? Because of the delicacy and diplomacy that it would come when it was revealed that AMLO was on the payroll, or at least his campaigns were financed in large part by cartel cash, right? So you're right. This has been pushed under the rug by administrations in Mexico, by the Biden administration here in the United States. And it is great that Cheryl Atkinson is still reporting on this and still uncovering, I think, incontrovertible facts about what, again, the source of these cartel guns in Mexico.
Well, think about it in these terms, too, because you're spot on. Think about it in these terms. The Biden administration, the Obama administration knew this was happening. And I think that's borne out by Cheryl's reporting. And by the way, as a shout out to Cheryl Atkinson, she did remarkable work at CBS. It still befuddles me that she maintained employed at CBS during all the time she was reporting what she was reporting. Maybe she was the token at CBS so they could say, see, we are fair, we are balanced. But she did great work on this story. But when you combine this with the fact that the American gun grabbers were working in unison, I want you to think about what that actually means. Because this was rivers of guns. What were they trying to do? They were trying to sue the U.S. firearms industry literally out of business, blaming U.S. manufacturers for cartel gun use. Now, I'm sure there are some Mexican police chiefs who are not corrupt. Cartel probably had a gun to their head and a lot of money in their pocket saying, this is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to do. Who knows how that corruption down there works? I'm not, you just said it. It's a failed narco state. But to blame U.S. manufacturers for that violence is incredible. And then I kind of tied that to a story out of Mississippi that A.W.R. Hawkins wrote over at Breitbart News, where you had two sheriffs and multiple police officers that were just popped in sting operations that were assisting drug purchases and sales down in the Mississippi Delta. Law enforcement, active duty law enforcement in this country. Where does every single dollar bill from a drug transaction originate and flow to? The Mexican cartels. Now, this is just scratching the surface. I'm not saying there's a connection between these two, but there is a connection when you look at how deep the corruption at the cartel level runs, not just in their country, but in our country as well. And don't think for 2 seconds those cops weren't taking big paydays. There's no question about it. Look, as we talked about last night, I think AWR mentioned last night, I don't know what kind of money was transacted. I don't know if that happened. Okay, we can make that probably a safe assumption that there was a lot of money changing hands. But again, it ties right back to the cartels. And when you look at what the administration knew and the American, there's no possible way that the gun grabbers did not know that this was the case, yet they continued to pursue American gun manufacturers to put them out of business and try to bankrupt them in using our courts to do so. To me, it's criminal. And the real question, Cam, is anybody ever going to be held accountable? I doubt it.
I doubt it too. What's interesting about that lawsuit, because Mexico sued, it seemed like, every major U.S. gun maker, except SIG. Mm-hmm. They didn't sue SIG. And I noted at the time that Mexico had just entered into a contract worth more than $100 million with SIG.
With SIG.
And I thought it was very interesting that, okay, oh, that company is okay, right? Because again, they're doing business with that company. Going back to Cheryl Atkinson's report, she talks about a 2023 document sourcing a year's worth of U.S. guns from Mexican crime scenes. She says 779 of them were originally bought by the Mexican government. No other source is anywhere close. But she looked at data from 2016 to 2023, confirming the Mexican government was the top buyer of U.S. guns later traced to crime scenes in Mexico, with the Mexican military listed as dealer, purchasing more than 2,000 firearms from 2016 through 2021 that turned up at crime scenes. So let me ask you, Mark. I mean, we've seen, actually, it was interesting. I mean, the Biden administration put curbs on firearm exports to a number of countries. I think it was more than 16 of them, right, where they said, well, we think that these guns could be diverted to bad actors. Mexico wasn't among them. Mm-hmm. How would you feel? I mean, we talk often about, it's time for gun makers to stop selling in California. Teach these anti-gunners a lesson. How would you feel if the Trump administration told Mexico, you're not purchasing any more of our firearms because you can't be trusted to keep those guns in the hands of military and law enforcement?
The knee jerk, like I said I think the last time we talked about this subject here on Cameron Company, I said the knee-jerk reaction in me says, to hell with California. Let them all suffer, including law enforcement. It's high time that the American firearms industry as a whole says enough. I mean, look at what they just did with Glock. HB 1127, as you and I have talked about and reported on many, many times, both together on this show and on our shows separately and independently, and what you've written about, et cetera. Look at what they did to Glock, yet they exempted law enforcement. Mm-hmm. If it's good enough for law enforcement, it's good enough for civilians, okay? So, yeah, that's the knee-jerk reaction in me. The hell with Mexico. Look, Mexico's murder rate is 5 times that of the U.S. Do you ever hear ABC, NBC, CBS, MSDNC, and CNN, LOL ever report that fact? Right. No. What they do report is the Iron River of American guns coming into the U.S., blaming civilians for selling to the cartel. What do they call them? Bad apple gun dealers. No, it turns out that all of those transactions were legitimate deals sold to the Mexican government, by the way, with the approval of the Biden administration and the Obama administration. So that's the knee-jerk reaction in me. The reality to that is, with the level of corruption in Mexico now, I don't know that that's fixable. And I'm just going to come out and say this without military action. Trump is leaning towards military action to stop these cartels. What does that mean for Mexico? I have no idea. I'm not suggesting that Trump invade Mexico militarily. I don't think that will ever happen. But you can also invade through banking, through sources, through money, through intelligence, et cetera. And I have a feeling that's probably already going on. I would not be shocked to learn that our special ops guys were working somewhere down in Mexico to try to thwart this cartel activity. To what degree, I have absolutely no idea. And quite frankly, we probably shouldn't know. That stuff needs to remain under wraps,
right,
for everybody's safety and security. But yeah, I mean, again, the knee-jerk reaction says the heck with them. Let them suffer. But Mexico's our southern neighbor. We share a border together. We have to find a way to fix this problem. The first way to fix it is to get the truth out there. And Cheryl Atkinson did amazing work in getting it out. And I do want to point out, she had I guess I can't call him an informant. She named him. His name was, I think, John Dodson, not mm-hmm. looking at the page, who was a former ATF agent that I guess blew the whistle here and went back and said, for a decade, we've been hearing all of this nonsense. And when I started doing a deeper dive, I'm paraphrasing him. You can read it in Cheryl's report in the Baltimore Sun. This is what I found. And he said he was flabbergasted. That was his word. He was flabbergasted. I'm not flabbergasted by it. I'm more flabbergasted that we knew about it, that two administrations knew about it, and this is the first we're hearing about it. So again, hats off to Cheryl Atkinson on this one. It was great reporting. Good job. And hats off to the Baltimore Sun for running it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dodson, if I recall correctly, was one of the original whistleblowers in Fast and Furious. His name has been around for a while. I'm pretty sure that he was one of the first ones to blow the whistle on that operation. If he's flabbergasted, it may be because, again, nothing has seemingly changed in the, you know, 14 years since Operation Fast and Furious first came to our attention. Like, that should have been, you know, and again, we could go down that rabbit hole. Just the idea that we're going to send guns across the border, we're going to put them in the hands of the cartels, and we're going to turn around and blame gun stores for arming the cartels when it was the government doing this. And you actually had gun stores objecting to this, saying, hey, I don't want this sale to go through. And ATF agents say, no, let it proceed. Let the sale proceed. Right. So the fact that we've known about that, and again, nothing has really changed. That, to me, I guess, is maybe the most flabbergasting thing about this, is that this is a known problem. Right. Cheryl Atkinson, I think, did a good job of shining a spotlight on what has continued to be a problem. But again, she did much the same reporting 15 years ago. Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was falling on deaf ears. And, you know, you go back to Fast and Furious. We're talking about the Obama administration and Eric Withholder. I always call him Eric Withholder, our illustrious AG at the time. They all knew this was happening because Fast and Furious was an intentional operation set up at the highest levels of the DOJ using lawful gun dealers in and around the Phoenix metropolitan area to funnel those guns illegally into Mexico. In many cases, against the best wishes of those dealers who were being told to sell those guns because it's okay, it's a government operation. Mm-hmm. They knew those guns were going to the cartel. They did it intentionally. You can't tell me for one second they didn't know that the other lawful purchases that were being made outside of Fast and Furious were also going to the cartels. They did know it. So that, again, begs the question of accountability here in the long run. When, again, I have to go back to the gun grabbers in the United States. There's only two options here. They either knew it or they're lying about it. They're either ignorant of the fact, let me put it that way, or they're lying about it. I can't believe for 2 seconds that Feinblatt and the rest of the anti-gun establishment, who was working so closely with both of those administrations, can sit back with plausible deniability and say, well, we didn't know. Guys, what they were trying to do was put the U.S. firearms business out of business, the entire industry. They were working behind the scenes with U.S. government, DOJ, and the White House in two previous administrations to do it. And if this doesn't open your eyes, you're asleep at the wheel. Please don't drive.
Yeah, you know, I'm just thinking back to the argument that Mexico made. And you know, Mexico in this lawsuit against these gun makers, they were assisted by a guy named Jonathan Lowey, former Brady campaign attorney. I think his group now is Global Action Against Violence. He's still active, right? He's still going after gun makers. But one of the arguments that they made was that, well, you know, the gun makers should have known that a certain number of their guns were going to be criminally diverted to the cartels. And they didn't take any action to stop it. Sounds to me like you could sue the Biden administration for the same thing, right? I mean, maybe even sue the first Trump administration, because Cheryl Lackenson talks about this going from 2016 to 2023. The U.S. government knew that a portion of these legitimate sales to the Mexican government were going to be handed off to the cartels. They knew because they were seeing these reports coming in each and every year, and yet they allowed these sales to take place. So,
well, hold on 1 second. Let's go back to the first Trump administration. You go from 2016 to 2020. The deep state was working overtime. We've seen that in action now. And I've said this before on this program. This country, I'm glad Trump didn't win a second back-to-back term, quite frankly. In hindsight, I'm glad, because the country needed to go through this pain to understand what it is the other side had in store for us, not just in theory and campaign talk, but in reality. We had to experience it in the long run. Again, overlooking our shoulder, we can now look back and go, what the hell just happened? Now we've seen it, we've lived it, we don't want to do it again, hence why Trump won in 2024 the way he did. But I'm not convinced Trump knew anything about this. The deep state was working against him from day one. The intelligence community was working against him. We've got 51 of them that were signing documents. They're now being held accountable. The left can't stand it. So I don't know what Trump knew in 2016 through 2020. I don't think he was aware of that. I think they kept a lot of it away from him.
I'm sure they did.
Behind the scenes. And here we go in 2024. Thankfully, thank God, this information is now beginning to come out. But it's astonishing. And I would love to see someone held accountable legally for this. But again, you know, the cynic in me says, we've been doing this for too long. It's not going to happen. The mere fact it's out, the mere fact that we're talking about it, I'll take as holding them accountable. At least it's out there and at least we're talking about it. And the more names we can name, I know you will. And I know I certainly will if we can find it out.
Absolutely. Mark Walters, my friend, it is always good talk with you. Appreciate you coming on the program today.
The pleasure is mine, brother. Thank you so much on a Monday.
Absolutely. Be sure to check out the Daily Defense from Mark. And then, of course, the Sunday Night Monster Cast, armedamericanradio.com. You can find terrestrial radio listings. You can listen to it live there on the website. But you definitely want to be getting your daily dose of 2A Freedom from Mark. So, Mark, thanks again, man. We'll talk again probably next Monday, I'm guessing.
You are very welcome. I'm ready when you are. Say the word and we'll pull the trigger.
All right, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Cam.
My thanks to Mark for another great conversation. Looking forward to doing this again. Perhaps as early as next Monday for another Mondays with Mark. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, which I don't know if this is a true recidivist report. But again, it's one of those cases that, in some cases, I can't even say, like, a lot of times we have these stories and it's what the heck were the prosecutors thinking? I have a feeling I know exactly what the prosecutors were thinking here. I don't like it. Here's the headline. Guilty plea in Rochester drug case involving $100,000 cash and gun. This is Rochester, Minnesota, by the way, not Rochester, New York. So according to KROC, a Rochester man who was convicted on a first-degree drug charge connected to a raid conducted earlier this year by the Southeast Minnesota Violent Crimes Enforcement Team is now given a chance to erase the conviction from his criminal record. According to Olmsted County Courts, 21-year-old Kobe Glenn Heil entered a guilty plea to the charge on Thursday, which involved the seizure of several hundred cannabis vape cartridges during a, quote, knock-and-announce search at an apartment in back in May. According to the criminal complaint, officers seized drugs weighing a total of 3.5 pounds. Again, these are little, you know, carts. So he has a pretty substantial number of those carts. The search also led to the discovery of more than $100,000 in cash, a cash counter, a heat sealer, and a large amount of cannabis packaging. A safe also found in the residence containing a pistol with no serial number and an empty Glock 9mm ammunition magazine. Now, they don't say that the gun was defaced in any way, so this may very well have been a home-built firearm. Highland ended up getting charged with first-degree drug possession, possession of a firearm with no serial number, and a misdemeanor count of third-degree sale of cannabis concentrate. Under his plea agreement, the firearm and the drug sale charges were dropped. So he pled guilty, I guess, to first-degree drug possession. Sentenced to 2 years probation. I was also given a stay of adjudication, which means that the felony conviction could be removed from his criminal record if he complies with the terms of his probation. So keeps his nose clean for 2 years. Criminal charge goes away. As KROC notes, the more than $100,000 cash that was seized in the drug raid is currently being targeted for forfeiture to the government under a civil lawsuit filed by the Olmsted County Attorney's Office. Now, I don't know about you, but it kind of sounds to me like they wanted the money more than they wanted the defendant here, right? And, you know, we've talked a little bit about the civil forfeiture laws at Bearing Arms. I don't know if we've talked about it much on Cam and Company. There's a case out of Illinois involving a gun store owner who was indicted on basically falsifying tax returns. The government seized millions of dollars worth of his property. Most of those charges, I think, ended up getting dropped. He's now fighting to get that property returned. The bar for civil asset forfeiture is ridiculously low. And my attitude when I see cases like this is, all right, listen, if you're going to give this guy a chance to wipe his record clean, if he stays out of trouble for 2 years, you hang on to that cash for 2 years. If you believe that that money was acquired through the illicit sale of narcotics, which, by the way, he's not been charged with. He was originally charged with, but the charges were dropped, right? He pled guilty to a charge of possessing drugs. So even then, why is the government entitled to this money? I mean, like, if you're going to prosecute this guy for being a drug dealer, you want to seize the money that you said he got dealing drugs. That's one thing. But if you're dropping the charges related to the sale of these drugs, and now you're accusing him simply of possessing a hell of a lot of marijuana carts, I take issue with the government trying to get that $100,000. Maybe I'm alone on this. I don't know. But to me, if there are no more allegations that this guy was dealing drugs, why are you taking his money? Why are you taking his money? If again, it would be a different story if they would continue to prosecute him for dealing drugs, and they said, "Well, this is the proceeds from that that illicit activity." If you're dropping the charges, no, I don't think you should be able to keep that cash. So I got to say, I have nothing. I don't know nothing about Mr. Heil, but I'm kind of rooting for him to get his money back. If this is the terms that the government agreed to for his criminal case, I kind of think they've lost their argument as to why they're entitled to that money. We'll, I'd say we're going to keep our eyes open for more details. I doubt we'll get any more, but I'll try to follow along, see what happens with Mr. Heil's case and his cash. On to today's armed citizen story, our case out of Iowa here. Officials rule Coralville woman was acting in self-defense in June shooting that killed man. And that's the headline. The story itself, a lot more equivocal, actually. Johnson County Attorney Rachel Zimmerman Smith, in a release on Halloween, said no charge will be filed against Michelle Jenkins Robertson, who was the woman who shot and killed 27-year-old Mason Edwards back on June 11th. The Johnson County attorney said their office determined, quote, there is not enough evidence to show that the force was not justified. Zimmerman Smith also said that the prosecutors could not find the evidence to, quote, rebut the legal presumption from Iowa Code Section 704.2A, which covers justifiable use of deadly force. The that language makes it sound like, well, maybe we don't think it was self-defense, but we just couldn't meet our burden. The release does go on to say, though, that the shooting was, quote, necessary to avoid injury or risk to her life or the safety of others, which should have been the lead, by the way. If that is what prosecutors determined, that this shooting was necessary to save her life, that's different than, well, we just don't know if we have an evidence to rebut her charge of self-defense. So let's talk about the case itself. The victim in this case, Michelle Jenkins Robertson, was in what she described as an intermittent relationship with Mason Edwards. No relation, by the way. But they were living apart when the shooting occurred. He called her, allegedly, shortly before he arrived at her home in June. When he got there, he, quote, forced his way through the front door of the home and then began arguing with her and then began physically assaulting her. According to prosecutors, he began punching her repeatedly, grabbed her hair, eventually placed her in a headlock. Jenkins Robertson tried to fight back. She was able to escape his grasp before she grabbed a gun that she had recently placed near her bed. She pointed that firearm at Edwards, told him to leave. According to investigators, she had the gun near her bed because of, quote, Edwards' escalating behavior in the days and weeks before he broke into her home and attacked her. Edwards allegedly refused to leave, moved closer to her, which is when she fired two shots, striking Edwards. She immediately called 911, according to investigators. She admitted that she shot Edwards. First responders arrived, rendered aid to Edwards, but he was pronounced dead at the scene. Jenkins Robertson told police that there had been a history of domestic violence between her and Edwards. According to records, police have been called three separate times to intervene in disputes between the pair. Although the attorney's release doesn't specify whether or not there were any previous physical altercations between the two. He, according to toxicology reports, had a blood alcohol concentration at the time of his death at 0.230, which is about three times the legal limit to drive. And I believe I was a 0.08 state. Now, again, if this is what prosecutors had determined happened, I don't know why it took this long to determine that this woman was acting in self-defense. She's in her home. Guy breaks into her home, physically assaults her in her home. She grabs a gun. She tells him to leave. He doesn't. He comes towards her. She fires a shot. I mean, how is that not a reasonable belief that your life is in danger? You've already been assaulted and attacked in your home by someone who shouldn't be there. You've told him to leave, and instead he's coming towards you. So, I don't know why it took this long for the investigation to be concluded, but it has been. And despite the sort of wishy-washy language from the Johnson County attorney, it sounds like Michelle Jenkins Robertson was indeed acting to defend herself when she shot and killed Mason Edwards back on June 11th. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, will enable to do the right thing. A much more lighthearted story out of Chesapeake, Virginia, where the local fire department says a good Samaritan saved some chickens from becoming, well, broiled alive in their coop. This was, it was a couple days ago. It was last Tuesday. The fire happened at a chicken coop. Somebody passing by saw the fire, managed to open the coop door and let the chickens out. They all escaped. When the firefighters arrived, they found the coop engulfed in flames. They deployed a hose, extinguished the fire. No chickens or people were injured. which is good news. Fire investigators say they have not determined what caused the fire. My guess is this time of year, somebody had placed a heater out in the coop in an attempt to keep their chickens warm, and that's what sparked the blaze. That I've seen that happen before. It's one of the many reasons I don't use a heater in my chicken coop. First of all, they're chickens. They're covered in feathers. They can brave the cold and a lot colder temperatures than you might think. If you're really concerned about their little feet or their comb, you can apply some Vaseline, and that'll help maybe, you know, protect them against frostbite. But for the most part, chickens don't need central heat and air to get by. They're not like humans. So I am assuming that this was a well-meaning chicken owner who just wanted to protect their flock and ended up roasting them instead. But not only did that good Samaritan save the chickens, but also it sounds like helped alert the fire department of what was going on and perhaps prevented that blaze from spreading to a structure occupied by humans and not just fowl. So there you go. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Anonymous Good Samaritan in Chesapeake, Virginia. We thank you for your clucking good deed. That has got to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com today for all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. Getting closer to the 2026 legislative season, so we're already starting to see bills pre-filed. We've got news out of Massachusetts for you in that regard. A lot of legal news percolating in the courts as well. And, of course, tomorrow, Election Day in New Jersey, Virginia. Got a red flag referendum in Maine. Local elections maybe where you live. It is critically important if you're a gun owner, get out and vote to protect your freedoms. All right, we'll see you back here tomorrow for the Tuesday Election Day edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.